This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 16th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a UN investigation finds evidence of chemical weapons use in Syria as doctors and health workers from around the world warn of a medical crisis in the country. On the anniversary of the 2008 financial crisis in the U.S., activists call for deeper economic reforms and some back a new chair to head the powerful Federal Reserve. And we go to Argentina, where the country's reliance on genetically modified soy crops is drawing criticism from environmentalists and local residents. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. At least 12 people are confirmed dead and an unknown number injured after a mass shooting at the U.S. Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. this morning. Police continue to search for two men in military-style dress who they describe as potential shooters. One other was killed at the scene. Staff at the facility were told to shelter in place, and nearby schools were placed on lockdown. D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier.
We are still doing an extensive search. This is a large base. We've got multiple agencies and multiple teams.
Despite earlier reports, the identity of the dead gunman is not yet known. In Cambodia, thousands of supporters of the country's opposition party rallied for a second straight day today, protesting the results of the disputed July 28 national elections. Longstanding leader Hun Sen claimed victory in that poll amid allegations of widespread voter fraud. Erwin Loy reports from the capital, Phnom Penh.
Prime Minister Hun Sen met with opposition leaders for 5 hours today. The talks with opposition rivals Sam Rainsy and Khun Sokha came at a critical point. Tension escalated Sunday when police shot and killed a man at a roadblock meant to keep opposition protesters away from the city. The leaders emerged Monday afternoon, promising to keep the peace. The opposition gained little ground on what has been its chief demand, to hold an independent inquiry into the July election. But opposition spokesperson Yim Sovan said the ruling party did agree to look at crucial election reforms.
We agree to form a committee for the electoral reform. We need to amend some law related to the election, and also we have to have new voter list.
During a late afternoon rally before thousands of supporters, opposition members framed it as a hard-won victory. Either way, the situation could come to a head next week. That's when Hun Sen is promising to convene the first session of the new National Assembly, and the opposition is threatening a boycott without further reforms. Erwin Loy, FSRN, Phnom Penh.
Floodwaters are receding in Colorado, though there is a 30% chance of thunderstorms today, and the National Weather Service has extended a flood watch until 7 p.m. Mountain Time tonight. KGNU's Joel Edelstein reports.
Chinook helicopters are in the air as the relief effort is now focused on rescuing people stranded in mountain communities due to blocked roads. Since Sunday morning, the number of people not accounted for has fluctuated from 212 to 430. Transportation officials expect repair of the extensive damage to structures and roads will take months. And no one knows the possible long-term effects of contamination from fracking fluids associated with flooded oil and gas wells, or from plutonium residue uncovered by flooding in the area of the Rocky Flats former nuclear weapons plant south of Boulder. Joel Edelstein, FSRN, Boulder.
A federal judge in Idaho has blocked General Electric from transporting enormous loads of equipment along a rural highway on their way to the Alberta tar sands. Lee Robartis has more.
The Nez Perce tribe and environmental group Idaho Rivers United sued the Forest Service, saying they had failed to use their authority to stop the first General Electric megaload from using the highway in August. 28 Nez Perce tribal members, including 8 out of 9 tribal executive committee members, were arrested last month for standing in U.S. Highway 12, blocking the nearly 650,000-pound tar sands shipment from entering the Nez Perce reservation. Nez Perce tribe executive committee member Brooklyn Baptiste said besides protecting treaty rights in Idaho, stopping the loads is also an act of solidarity with Canadian First Nations tribes.
their way of life, their belief systems, all tied to the environment. And when that environment gets disrupted or annihilated completely and unrepairable, that affects the way those tribes, those First Nations, future operates. They're no longer connected to a land that's been decimated.
The ruling means that before megalodes are allowed to travel the 100-mile-long federally designated wild and scenic river corridor, the Forest Service must consult with the Nez Perce tribe and conduct a study of the intrinsic values of the land. Lee Robartis, FSRN, Moscow, Idaho.
A North Carolina police officer is charged with voluntary manslaughter today after shooting an unarmed black man over the weekend. Early Saturday morning, 24-year-old Jonathan Farrell knocked on the front door of a house in Charlotte, apparently to ask for help after crashing his car. The resident called police. According to a police spokesperson, when officers arrived, Farrell ran toward them. They tased him. When he continued to approach them, Officer Randall Carrick shot and killed the former Florida A&M football player. And in New York, police officials are investigating after officers fired at a disoriented pedestrian who was flailing through traffic. When the man pulled his hand out of his pocket and mimed shooting, police fired their weapons. They missed the man, but hit two bystanders, knocking one of them from her walker. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The United Nations team investigating the alleged chemical weapons attack that took place in a Damascus suburb last month released a 38-page report on their findings today. Investigators concluded that chemical weapons were used on a relatively large scale in the August 21st attack against civilians, including children. The report cites evidence of sarin in blood and urine samples of survivors on surface-to-surface rockets and near the sites of the attacks. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke to reporters today after a meeting in a closed session of the Security Council.
There must be accountability for the use of chemical weapons. Any use of chemical weapons by anyone, anywhere, is a crime. But our message today must be more than that. Do not slaughter your people with gas. There must be also no impunity for the crimes being committed with conventional weapons.
Ban Ki-moon also expressed concern about arms flowing into the region as atrocities are committed by both sides. As fighting continued on the ground in Syria, the head of the International Commission of Inquiry, Sergio Pinheiro, addressed the UN Human Rights Council with similar concerns. He said neither side was respecting the rules of engagement during war.
Failure to bring about a settlement has allowed this conflict not only to deepen in its intransigence, but also to widen, expanding to new actors and to unimaginable crimes. Neither law nor decency has restrained the behavior of all the parties. Influential states have an obligation to ensure that the parties to the conflict comply with the laws of war.
Over the weekend, U.S. and Russian negotiators reached an agreement on chemical weapon disarmament by the Syrian regime, and the U.N. said it received documents from Syria on Saturday in its initial steps to join the 1992 chemical weapons ban treaty. But despite the diplomatic progress, Secretary of State John Kerry continued to warn of possible military action. He spoke from Paris along with the French and British foreign ministers.
We will not tolerate avoidance or anything less than full compliance by the Assad regime to the core principles of what has been achieved here. If Assad fails to comply with the terms of this framework, make no mistake, we are all agreed, and that includes Russia, that there will be consequences.
UK Foreign Minister William Hague said that a diplomatic path was still being pursued to end the crisis.
Our goal remains to convene a second Geneva conference to bring all sides together to agree a political solution to the conflict, and we will work with Russia on bringing that about as soon as possible.
As diplomatic negotiations continue, many remain concerned about the living conditions for Syrians. Doctors and medical workers around the world are warning of a humanitarian crisis in Syria, where the conflict continues to severely restrict access to vital medicine and health care. In an open letter published today in the medical journal The Lancet, more than 50 health professionals called on the world community to immediately address the crisis, saying fighting has devastated the country's hospitals, putting at risk civilians who seek life-saving care. For more, we're joined by Ron Waldman. He's professor of global health at George Washington University, also president of the board of directors of Doctors of the World USA. He's one of the signatories of today's letter in The Lancet. Welcome to FSRN.
Pleasure to be here.
War in Syria has had a heavy toll, not just on the people, the residents, but also the infrastructure that Syrians depend on to get health care. Nearly 40% of hospitals destroyed, another 20% severely damaged, according to the World Health Organization. Let's start with, what is the state of infrastructure at this point?
Well, that's correct. The destruction is not only of hospitals and health facilities, but also of pharmaceutical plants and of vehicles and all of the elements that constitute the infrastructure of a health system. War has really taken its toll on the medical system, as we say in the letter to the editor today. And without an functioning infrastructure, it makes it very difficult for people to receive appropriate health care services.
And in the absence of this infrastructure, is it clear where people are going in order to get the health care they need?
Sure. They are receiving services from health care professionals within Syria who are doing the best that they can. However, I would hasten to add that there has been targeting of health care professionals as well. Doctors and other health care providers have been isolated and pinpointed for damage and recriminations. So it makes it all the more difficult for non-combatants and healthcare professionals to come together.
You note the targeting of healthcare workers themselves, and in the letter published today, you note a figure that 470 healthcare workers, or around 470 healthcare workers, are currently imprisoned. What kind of climate does this create for those who are trying to treat those who need help?
It creates a climate of fear and intimidation. Many of the healthcare providers are demonstrating incredible courage in trying to exercise their profession in accordance with the obligations that they took and the oaths that they took to be able to provide care to those in need. The problem is not that there are not healthcare professionals willing to continue working under very, very adverse circumstances. The problem is that there's a gulf that has been built up between the population in need of healthcare services and those able to provide them with those services.
Now, it's not just wounds or injuries that are direct results of violence, but also outbreaks of disease, of typhoid, hepatitis, cholera, also other chronic diseases. How does this contribute to the health needs of people in Syria?
It detracts from their ability to get healthcare services for whatever their condition might be. As you point out, there is a risk of epidemics, and epidemics have occurred. There are in this middle-income country, many of the people present with more chronic diseases, cardiovascular conditions, diabetes, cancer, for which people had been treated, but for which they have no longer access to those treatments. There has been no vaccination for children since the start of the war 2 years ago. So it means that there's a total breakdown of the entire medical system, which is going to have a terrible, terrible impact on the health status of the population overall.
Dr. Ron Waldman at George Washington University, you and other healthcare professionals from around the world are calling on the Syrian government and all armed groups to allow access to patients. You're also calling on the UN or another international body to facilitate medical access for people in Syria. Can you point to a positive example of how healthcare has been delivered successfully amid a conflict zone in light of what's going on here in Syria?
Well, sure, there are different solutions for different problems. The problem is always the same, and that is exactly as you stated it, that healthcare providers need access to populations, populations need access to healthcare providers. Whatever can be done to facilitate their coming together are things that are going to improve the humanitarian situation. There's been so much discussion of Syria lately, of a political nature, of a military nature. I think it's quite important that we all be aware that there are real people pursuing real lives who are getting caught in the middle of all of this debate and discussion, and those people have serious problems that are not being met because of the inability of healthcare providers to reach them and the inability on their part to reach their healthcare providers. That's the problem that we're trying to address head on, and we hope that a solution will be found in the near future.
Dr. Ron Waldman is professor of global health at George Washington University, also president of board of directors of Doctors of the World USA. He's one of more than 50 signatories to a letter published in The Lancet that's drawing attention to the healthcare crisis in Syria. Dr. Waldman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
This week marks two anniversaries in recent U.S. economic history: the 2008 financial crisis, and the 2011 birth of the Occupy movement. While some current and former lawmakers say the executive branch has dragged its feet on crucial reforms, Occupy activists point to the need for alternatives to capitalism in the wake of government and corporate failure. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
In a speech commemorating the deep economic recession triggered by the collapse of Lehman Brothers and other major financial institutions 5 years ago, President Obama said the country is not yet where we need to be, especially in terms of unprecedented and widening inequality.
The top 1% of Americans took home 20% of the nation's income last year, while the average worker isn't seeing a raise at all. In fact, that understates the problem. Most of the gains have gone to the top 0.1%.
The president listed the steps his administration has taken to prevent further damage and help those most impacted, including the stimulus bill, the auto company bailout, healthcare reform, and the financial regulations of the 2009 Dodd-Frank law. But former Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, a key architect of that law, criticized the government for failing to implement many of its major reforms. Speaking in Washington Monday, he said he's also seen a lot of anger from the public because no Wall Street executive has gone to jail for the risky and sometimes illegal behaviors that led to the 2008 recession. He said prosecuting bankers would be an effective deterrent for future wrongdoing, but said there's a major reason why that hasn't happened.
The Securities Exchange Commission and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission are both grievously underfunded. When the Republicans took over the House in 2010, they decided in the budget to significantly underfund. The CFTC gets about $300 million to run this whole industry. If we begin to get tough on these people, they will litigate. And they have resources beyond what we have. And a couple of those cases can sort of exhaust us.
While the federal government has failed to hold bankers accountable, activists with Occupy Wall Street and its offshoots are working to create alternatives. As the movement prepares to celebrate its two-year anniversary this week in cities across the country, organizer Priscilla Grimm in New York City told FSRN what Occupy activists are doing to meet the region and country's most pressing needs.
You have the Strike Debt group. They are actually buying blocks of debt, and they are canceling it out so that people will no longer have to worry about, you know, years-old medical bills anymore. We also have Occupy Sandy that's still going strong. It erupted in the face of Hurricane Sandy last year to help out the Far Rockaways and other really hard-hit areas. And so they've evolved to this place where they're helping to build businesses in the communities where they're working. They have a really interesting co-op program that's going on right now where they are working with different groups to create worker-owned businesses. So all of these things are actually looking at brand new economic models.
President Obama will soon make a major choice impacting how his administration tackles inequality and unemployment for the rest of his time in the White House, appointing a new chair of the Federal Reserve. The presumed favorite for the job, former Treasury Department official Larry Summers, withdrew his candidacy last weekend. Progressive groups celebrated his stepping out of the running, citing his aggressive push for deregulation of Wall Street during the Clinton administration. Many groups, including the National Organization for Women and Democracy for America, are petitioning the president to tap Janet Yellen, the current vice chair of the Federal Reserve. A study by the Wall Street Journal published earlier this summer found that Yellen was correct more often than any other Fed policymaker in her predictions about inflation, growth, and unemployment in the U.S. economy over the past several years. A longtime advocate for more aggressive action to boost employment, she would also be the first woman in U.S. history to hold the position. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Soybeans and soy derivatives make up about a quarter of Argentina's exports, and over 90% of the country's soy crops are genetically modified. Some activists say that these genetically modified plants and the herbicides that accompany them hurt both environmental and human health. But soy farmers and multinational agricultural companies have substantial political clout in Argentina, so environmentalists are struggling to make their voices heard. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill has more.
Cesar Soldano has been farming in the Argentine provinces of Córdoba and Santiago del Estero for over three decades. In the spring and summer, he plants soy and corn. But now, it's winter, and green garbanzo shoots cover his fields. Córdoba is a desert region, and Soldano says it used to be covered with scrubland, tough desert plants and trees that could survive the region's long droughts.
Here, crops have replaced the scrubland, which naturally is not productive. One could say that it's more natural and that it doesn't hurt the ecosystem, but with that ecosystem, we can't feed Argentina, and we can't develop, and we wouldn't have anything to live on.
Now, there's no scrubland to be seen along the hour-long drive from Soldano's house to his fields. Glyphosate, the herbicide marketed by Monsanto in conjunction with Roundup Ready Soy, enabled Soldano and other farmers to transform this desert into arable land. Cesar Soldano says even in the winter, Córdoba's farmers leave their fields covered with glyphosate to kill all plant life so that nothing absorbs the soil's scarce water. He adds that all agricultural activity requires some manipulation of the natural environment. Genetically modified soy first appeared in Argentina in 1996, and now over 50% of the country's farmland is dedicated to soy plants. After the country's economic crash in 2001, soy exports helped the country return to solvency. President Cristina Kirchner and her predecessor Néstor Kirchner levied steep taxes on soy exports, up to 68%, according to farmer Soldano, to pay for social projects, such as monthly cash payments to poor families with children. Enrique Viale, the president of the Argentine Association of Environmental Lawyers, says soy itself caused much of the economic inequality the Kirchners are supposedly fighting.
La soja transgénica como tal está avanzando sobre distintos territorios.
Genetically modified soy is advancing over various territories, indigenous territories, rural territories, territories where people with various ways of life lived. And these populations, after being expelled from the countryside, end up in the outskirts of Argentina's big cities. And a vicious cycle begins because the money brought in by exporting soy ends up paying for the welfare payments of those excluded from the system.
Leading the fight against genetically modified soy in Argentina is Sofia Gatica, a resident of Ituzaingó, a suburb of Córdoba. Although she didn't have any prior organizing experience, Gatica decided to take on soy farmers after her baby died of kidney failure at 3 days old in 1999. Another child often suffered from illnesses that left him temporarily paralyzed from the waist down.
Because I feared I would lose my son,
I went out to a door-to-door survey to see what was happening in my neighborhood and why we were all getting sick. What was happening wasn't normal. In my block, I have one neighbor who lost her child. Susana had lost her child when he was 1 year old. Vero had lost her child. Marcela had lost her child. Beatrice had a sick child. Juan had lupus. The woman next door had cancer.
All of these families lived on just one block. Initially, Gatica had no idea that glyphosate and other agrotoxins were responsible for the health problems faced by her community, which is surrounded by soy fields.
My son played in the soy fields because I lived about 150 feet from the field. Not just my son, but all the kids from the block played there. I brought them there to play. We saw the plane when it sprayed the poison, but we didn't know it was toxic. We were never told that it was harmful. The kids played hide-and-seek in the field while the plane fumigated.
Gatica asked the government to investigate the community's health problems, and it was scientists who identified glyphosate as the culprit. Andres Carrasco, a doctor at the University of Buenos Aires, found that glyphosate can cause birth defects and spontaneous abortions in all vertebrates by increasing the amount of retinoic acid in embryos' blood.
This is not a discovery, it's a confirmation that what the people say happens really does happen. It's not some sort of collective paranoia. The problem is the denial, not glyphosate itself, but the denial that glyphosate affects human health and the health of the environment.
To demand that the government take action to address Ituzaingó's health problems, Gatica and a group of her neighbors blocked roads and used their bodies to prevent fumigator planes and pesticide-spraying trucks from spraying the fields near their homes. Gatica has faced considerable resistance to her campaign against genetically modified soy in Argentina. One day, she came home from grocery shopping to find a man with a gun in her kitchen.
He told me to stop messing with soy, that he would get me. I reported him to the police, and the police asked me if I had written down his license plate. I hadn't. How was I going to write down his license plate if he was threatening me inside the house?
Gatica says this incident and other threats have not lessened her determination.
All the towns are asking for areas of protection, that no one spray pesticides next to where people live, that they leave a mile and a half or a mile.
Those demands are beginning to have results. In 2008, the mothers of Ituzaingó won a municipal ordinance banning terrestrial pesticide spraying within a mile of their community and aerial pesticides spraying within a mile and a half. And last year, a court in Córdoba found a soy farmer and a fumigator plane pilot guilty of causing harm by spraying near residences. Gatica and other activists hope to use that case as a precedent to begin to hold soy farmers responsible for the harm they cause.
We say no to Monsanto, no to the seed law, yes to organic food, and no to agrotoxins.
The seed law is a bill that the Ministry of Agriculture plans to send to the national legislature before the end of the year. It would prohibit Argentina's larger farmers from gathering and saving seeds from their genetically modified crops and would instead require them to buy new seeds from biotech companies each year. Gatica is fighting that legislation, and she also aims for a nationwide ban on glyphosate and on aerial pesticide spraying. Ailish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Rose Katapshi. Thanks for listening today in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.